Welcome to the FMCG podcast. Give us a follow on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us out. Enjoy the show. Hi, good morning. My name's Rich and we're Consumer Hub. We focus on recruiting, marketing, innovation and sales professionals across the FMCG sector. And this is the FMCG podcast where we discuss leadership with some of the leaders that we rate who are interested in coming on the show, which is really exciting because today we've got Alex Hunter from Audience Collective. And Alex has a background in shopper, insight, marketing category. He's over there waving. Alex, give us a quick intro into you and audience, what you've done and what you're doing at the moment.
I'm Alex, as he said. Audience Collective is a group of specialists. We're quite proud of being marketing specialists across basically the whole gamut of marketing. I'm a group sales director, but I think the point is that we are changing the face of marketing and at the same time changing the face of sales, in that we don't have people who just come in and, you know, sell you a watch. We care about what you're doing, and that's why they put someone like me in the role. Because I genuinely do care about the marketing industry. I do care about the marketing problems that people face. And I genuinely want to try and help solve them. And I'm very fortunate in that we've got most of the tools that are capable of solving most marketing problems.
Yeah, sound. One of the things that, I'm just putting a bit of smoke up your bum here, Alex, but one of the things that I like about Alex's content on LinkedIn is that he actually talks about shopper marketing in a way that a numbskull like me can get my head around who isn't a marketing manager. Because shopper marketing is one of these things, it's got a bit of mystique about it. People talk about it, it's about trade marketing, investment, all these buzzwords. What does it actually mean? So today on the podcast, we just wanted to focus a little bit on some of Alex's insights into shopper marketing and consumer behaviour. But just for those that are uninitiated into the mysteries of marketing, Alex, like me, that are listening or watching, can you just give us a punchy summary on what you think shopper insights and consumer behaviour is as a bit of a discipline, and what it's all about in terms of understanding it and why we do it? What's it all about?
Yeah, so I use the language of behavioural science quite often when I talk about shopper, because the best possible way to talk about it is nudge. And it isn't behavioral science necessarily, but you just by executing well in store, you just make it a little bit more likely that someone will buy your product versus someone else. You do shopper insight to try and figure out what to do, and try to figure out how to lay out a space or what point of sale you might want to put up. But then the execution of it is just make it a bit more likely to make someone buy you. And the money is pouring in to shopper now. I mean, it's really pouring into shopper, because it naturally does. You know, when you see people scrabbling around at these types of recessionary periods, people go, well, actually, we need to do some activation work, and not necessarily correctly, but the money is pouring in regardless. And that is, it's purely about connecting the salience that you've already built up over the years with that product in stores. And that might be online, that might be in a physical retail. But all you're doing is just connecting that bank of salience that you've built up with the product in store, which quite frankly is what marketing's all about. And interestingly, a few years back, I listened to a podcast with a famous behavioral scientist, Rory Sutherland, who said, you know, but bearing in mind, Rory Sutherland works for an advertising agency. Mm. And he said, you should always start with working backwards. So where a lot of marketers might start with the brand, he says, actually, start with the store. Start with the point at which someone is going to buy something, because that's the pounds that go in your till. So start there and work backwards, because if there's a problem with how you get seen in store, then there's no point shoving a load of advertising at it. You know, there's no point trying to build your brand if you can't even be found inside the shop. And so that is the whole point of the shopper marketing spectrum, is make sure you can be found in store, so that when your brand marketing colleagues go and do a load of heavy lifting, because there's a lot more money that's spent on that side of the fence, make sure that it's actually going to go and get bought.
Yeah, Randall, that's really interesting. It kind of leads nice into my next question, actually, because one of the things that I've noticed as a recruiter is on a bad day, you know, brand managers, brand directors, it's all about the brand. It's all about the brand. Why it's so good. Let's talk about our brand and why it's so good. On a bad day, salespeople are all about sales. This is what I did. This is the boxes that I shifted. And the conversation completely misses out the person it serves, completely misses out the consumer and the shopper. Now I know everyone's into consumer insights, shopper insights, but often it does seem like these are kind of bolt-ons that sort of massage the real dynamic of, let's talk about the brand, let's talk about me and my sales. So thinking selfishly for anybody that's listening that's maybe in sales or brand, you know, what benefits does a brand have or does a salesperson have, or maybe a brand manager specifically in their context and what they have to deliver for the company have to actually put the spotlight on the shopper? You know, what kind of, just for somebody's kind of like world that they're in, like what the actual benefits to them themselves, not just to the business, but like, how does it make their job easier? How does it make their life easier?
It is fairly desperately sad for somebody who spent so long in their career, connecting people to people, that is still a problem that we have. I mean, I think it's fair to say that I have spent more time inside shops talking to customers of those shops than most, but certainly almost certainly than the average of every retail employee, excepting the ones on the shop floor. You have to connect with the people that buy products, that use your products, because that is the whole point of marketing. The whole point of marketing is to be the voice of the consumer, be the voice of the customer, be the voice of the shopper. And if you cannot connect well with the human side of marketing, which is the people that are out there, you're going to make poorer choices. And historically, I mean, you go back not even that far. You go back to the early parts of my career, which is not that far away. And we were making a lot more of our decisions based on gut feel. And that gut feel was not just guesswork. It was an amalgamation of all the stuff that we were holding in our heads.
Collective intuition.
Exactly. And that's built up by, you know, going and speaking to people in stores, you know, doing the work to understand the human angle. And I talk about a guy that I adore, who runs a shop in Settle, which is out in the hills in Yorkshire. And he's called Trevor, and love the guy. Trevor runs one shop, and he spends almost every day in the shop. So he's not, you know, he's not outside that shop. He serves most of the people that go into the shop, and he knows that shop inside out. And he sells a bizarre range of products, food and all sorts. He calls it Trevor's Market Shop, so you kind of get an understanding of what it is.
Check it out if you're watching.
And if you're in Settle, go and visit it. But Trevor knows his customers. He knows them completely. He doesn't need gut feel. He knows them. You know, he knows them by name. They're all held in his head. And he knows what they buy. And when he goes out on his buying runs, he knows what to purchase because he knows exactly what the people he's serving needs. Now, when you scale that up to the point where you're Tesco or PepsiCo or whomever, you lose that connection completely. And so the point of insight is to try and bridge that connection back again. But all you need to do is have, on one hand, your insight partners and your data partners providing you with that. But you still need a bit of that gut feel. Mm. You still need to know. Because data, you can tell, I know more than anyone, that you can tell any story you fancy with data. And you therefore need a bit of a balance to it. So if you don't still go out and spend five more minutes staring at a shelf and watching people go past it, or five more minutes asking your next door neighbor why they brush their teeth the way they do, you're going to miss some key elements that allows you to challenge the ideas that your Insight colleagues might have. And I genuinely think that so much more could be achieved collectively with that extra 5 minutes of work.
That's really interesting, yeah. I mean, these nice and smart questions. So what is the difference then between like the kind of typical retail categories data that people are going to be familiar with, like, you know, like Kantar, Nielsen, IRI, and the types of kind of qualitative insights that you collect at audience in the various kind of business units there?
I mean, look, largely Kantar, Nielsen, IRI, Kantar a little bit different. So Kantar has Worldpanel, which is pretty well known. It's essentially built by understanding behaviour. It's built because they've got a panel of people who scan their receipts, etc., and do some clever bits behind the scenes. Largely, that's how they build it. They're a big behavioural database. They know what people buy. Nielsen has a very similar one called Home Scan, I seem to recall it being called. But they mostly trade off their buy-in of EPOS data from the retailers and redistributing it with some anonymization. IRI do exactly the same. That is all behavioural data. And that's great and really, really useful and actually pretty core to the industry. Obviously, Kantar does tons more than just that. I don't think it'd be fair to say that it's all they do, but that's what category people probably know them best for. What I say to people, though, is that so when I used to do it, and it was quite a few years ago, I was a category manager, but when I used to buy that data, I was spending 90 grand a year. Maybe I was being ripped off, but 90 grand a year on that kind of data. And it would tell me what was being bought, but it would never tell me why. And so I used to spend a lot of time standing around in stores, hanging around like a bad smell, chatting up old ladies. Trying to figure out why they bought cake in particular at the time, which your former colleague got me the job, actually, Rich.
Yeah.
What I say to people now is that by just spending a couple of grand on sending someone into store to ask old ladies why they buy cake, you get a shed load of richness from it. And it was funny, a little while back, I won't name the name, but we were doing some work for a person that makes drinks, and and these particular drinks are fairly viscous, and we were observing the behavior, and every single person that picked up the drink off the shelf would do this with it. They'd shake it, and it's something innate in us. They'd do it without thinking about it, without conscious thought. They're just innate in what they do, is they shake it because it feels nice to a degree. It gives a good sense of there being the right volume in there. It gives you the idea that it's that nice viscous drink. You're excited to drink it. And it just was a natural thing. And it's really interesting that you would never get that from the data. You can never get that from any data source you like. Well, it is fascinating.
I've done it myself. That's what I'm thinking. It's interesting. Because I can literally picture myself doing it.
You just do. It's a thing that we like. And I don't know why we like it, but it's a thing that we like. It's a thing that just happens. And look, maybe you can't do anything with that, but maybe you can. And maybe a marketer with enough creativity in their bones can go, I can play with that a bit. I can do something with that, because that behavior is happening. That behavior is going on. That behavior can't get recorded anywhere, but that behavior is innate in us. And if you can connect something that is innate in us as people, when we buy, that we enjoy, if you can connect them with that and you can connect that to a brand, you've got something very fucking powerful. And I think that you can spend 2 grand doing that and boom, you've got something. There are few times that I have gone into a store and done something with the fixture where I haven't come out with something that powers something quite interesting, and I guarantee it returns on investment. It always does, because it can't not.
Yeah, yeah. So it's obviously like there's this gap then between sometimes that creative spark of intuition and the big data. It's kind of how would you sort of describe that gap? Like what is it that's sometimes missing? I know we talked about collective intuition before, but
it's too much data, and we all know that it's too much data. And I think there is starting to be, you know, 10 years ago we were getting very excited about big data. We were getting very excited about the idea that we could get more and more and more and more and more because we didn't have a lot. And then we got more and more and more and more and more. And still, the problem is most of the data is not that well structured. They're still not very well structured. So computers are pretty rubbish at trying to interpret it. And you can name multiple examples of where the best data companies in the world have tried to make data deliver results that they are expecting, and it's failed. Google have got plenty of examples of it. There is too much data, and our reliance on data to only tell the story is a concern. Now, we've got a data integrations business inside Audience Collective, and so I at this point there's an advert. Box Harry's an excellent, fantastic data business, but I cannot stress enough that if you are only relying on your data and you have a recognition that you are blind to a lot of other things, just go out and talk to some people, and you'll find an amazing volume of insight that will help you explain some of the things that are happening in data.
Yeah,
will happen. I know people are pretty well aware of this. I think people are not unaware of the fact of the power of insight. But I also think that the research industry as a whole, which has grown hugely, has got a lot to answer for not saying no enough and not saying that's a stupid question or no, we can't answer that. And I think that has tarnished to a degree the reputation of the entire industry, because you've ended up with watery results. And what that has meant is that a lot of people go, not a bloody focus group. We all know what will happen in a focus group. You'll just get, you know, what they want to tell you. And it's true that they will, but not if you ask the right questions. And too often briefs are taken and you know, because everyone's scrabbling around at times to bring in the cash, they go, yeah, we can answer that, sure.
Okay.
$5,000, is that all right? And they go, yeah, go on then. And then they, you know, gather a load of, you know, tired executives in leatherhead on a rainy Tuesday. And it's grey, and, you know, the consumers troop in, they sit down dutifully, and you get the angry one that shouts a lot. And you get the quiet ones that we constantly try to get something out, and they all nod along and they go, yep, no. And then the executives troop back out again and go back to their desks and think they've wasted their time. And I don't entirely hate focus groups, but I do think they don't solve a lot. The best thing the industry could possibly do is say no more. Tell clients you literally cannot do that. It's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we did that, we would have a better connection to people overall, because people would start to trust the industry more.
It's almost like people spend so long reading about the shopper and the consumer, they just never actually take the effort to get to know them. You know.
So my extensive collection of reading about the shopper and the consumer.
to come onto your reading list at the end, actually. Okay, that's a very quick plug. I mean, there's lots of industry people probably listening to this and watching it. Just give us a very quick run through on like the business units, the audience. I just want people to kind of get a view on the services.
Fair enough. Cheers, Rich. Fantastic media agency, mostly focused on digital, but you know, digital is everything these days, called Crunch. They do a fantastic job of being really intelligent about planning campaigns. An amazing advertising agency called Ponderosa, responsible for growing some brands that you'd be really excited of. You know, Hisense is a fantastic example. Mm. You know, number one brand in fridges, number three, I think, in tellies. You know, they do some fantastic work. Spark, of course, our insights agency. Box Harry, data integrations agency, web apps, web developments. The rest of the group is largely consultancy businesses. So we have fantastic educations consultancy. We've got some great guys doing fantastic work in retail. It's SEO, do some fantastic work in SEO. It's multifaceted to the extent that even I struggle with it sometimes.
It's fine. Yeah. I won't test you on it. But just kind of building back some of those big picture insights around your expertise into insights into leadership and career, Alex. For people that are in the food and drink industry that want to get involved in Shopper Insight, that want to actually get to know the shopper and the consumer, not just sell to them or kind of, you know, push their brand onto them, it might be in supply chain, in a commercial link-up role. It might be, you know, you're currently just, you know, a sales admin straight out of uni, but you want to get to know the shopper and understand the consumer. What is the best way people can go about developing that knowledge that's kind of about that connection rather than just the data?
I mean, when I was a young'un, I spent a career stacking shelves initially. That was my first job, really. I mean, I stacked trolleys originally, but then stacked some shelves and got brought in from the cold. And I always loved shops. So it's kind of innate inside me to love retail. And because of that, I spend an unhealthy amount of time inside supermarkets. My wife is, I took my wife on holiday once, and she was a little suspicious about why we were going on holiday to Swindon. but Waitrose had opened a new concept store just outside Swindon at the time.
Swindon.
And I convinced her that we were going to Avebury, the Stone Circle, but I did need a little stop off. and that's my life. I obsess over it. But I can appreciate that not everybody is wanting to take their wife. If she wasn't my wife at the time, it's amazing that she stuck with me. They might not want to take their wife to open Ziv concept stores in Swindon. And therefore, the best thing I can possibly say is, firstly, generally speaking, at Christmas, everybody who's remotely connected to the retail industry generally is asked, will you go into store and help us over Christmas? It's kind of a norm. And if you get that opportunity, absolutely take it. You get to spend, a couple of days at Christmas at the busiest possible time of the year, witnessing what it's like to be inside that store doing all sorts of random stuff. And I have a friend who works for a festival business, and it's quite fascinating that you don't realize it until you go and stand and see it from a commercial perspective. But when a festival happens, you spend, you know, the 364 days of the year selling this festival, and then every single one of your customers arrives on site at the same time, and that's you then have the whole customer experience that you spent 364 days of the year preparing for happening in that tiny space of time. And it's not dissimilar to Christmas retail, because all of your customers arrive on site, you know, and go through that the motions. And that is the core of what we're doing. And everything, every part of the retail business aligns to that. Finance. You know, how does finance affect that? Well, they need to have the right cash flow in place. They need to set the right systems up in place. They need to make sure that people's payments, you know, even really simple things like every store is connected through by a phone line to the EPOS system to go to head office to log every transaction. You know, that needs to be big enough to make sure it can cope with all different transactions. The supply chain, obviously, getting products into store. That, I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. I worked in cold supply chain at one point, and, you know, getting chilled products. You know, some products have just a 2-day lifespan between leaving at a production line and being able to be eaten. 2 days. You know, imagine the logistics that needs to go into getting that product from the manufacturer to the consumer in time. And that is incredibly difficult at Christmas because you've got vast volume of it. So if you do nothing, go into store at Christmas because it is the lifeblood of retail. And otherwise, just spend an extra 5 minutes hanging around a shelf because people don't notice you. So people will never notice you're there. Nobody will ask you any questions. If you start taking photos, you might get bundled out of the store by a security guard. But generally speaking, people don't notice you. And people generally act normally. And when they act normally at the shelf, you get to observe what's going on. And staff act normally as well. That's the interesting thing. That's the thing I find really interesting is that you get to see what staff like. And years ago, I worked in a business where we were highly competitive as a team, and each year we'd predict who would be the winners and losers in retail that year, and I would consistently win it, and they always kind of went, well, how do you know? How do you get it? How do you like? We'd predict it down to the plus or minus figures, and I always said I really ought to be betting on it somehow, and I don't know if bookies would take that bet, but Tesco
sounds like a game insight idea there.
but they'd always say, "How do you know?" And one of the major ways in which I'd know was I'd spend time. I mean, I always spend time in stores, but one of the major reasons I'd know is watch staff. So if you go in store at Christmas and you see the staff working as efficiently and effectively as you possibly can, it tends to suggest that store is going to operate very much in line with their target expectations. If you see a load of staff dicking about on their phones and having a ball, and it also, you know, it looks quiet, it's not so tidy, availability, all that kind of stuff. But if you see that, you know they're not going to perform that year because they've got too many staff, which means they're very unlikely to be doing well with against their target expectations. So yeah, go and watch things.
That's really interesting. Yeah, go and spend some time in a store, watch what's going on,
or read this book.
Okay, well, that's the next question: is what resources do you recommend people kind of look at? So Why We Buy. That's by Paco Underhill.
Paco Underhill, it's an absolute classic, and really, I mean, there's another one that I don't think I've got as a physical book here, but there's another one called Consumerology. It's written by Philip Graves, and if you don't like Paco Underhill, because to be honest, some of his ways of writing is a little bit annoying because he's American. I apologise if he turned up.
We'll forget it.
But Philip Graves is not, and he talks about the same kind of stuff, and he does it in a very different way, and he also sets out a reason why you should never do market research, which is marginally amusing. But those two books, for me, I read them very early in my career, and they changed the way I think about stores and think about, you know, what people do when they're in stores. And it really helps with shopper marketing. It really helps to clarify what you need to do if you're going to carry out any kind of shopper marketing activity, and also helps the marketers think about how they need to help their colleagues. You know, how does brand salience move from the television through to the store or anything or social? I mean, social media feeds. We do loads of work with really nice challenger brands, and it's kind of our thing, to be fair, which is taking people from sort of zero to hero, and challenger brand social feeds. They obviously get started out by really passionate founders, and they don't deliver the salience they need. As an advert anyway, which I'm fairly suggesting that social is only there as an advert, but you have to connect your brand assets all the way through onto your product. And I did some work a while back with Northern Monk, who really great craft beer business. I won't exactly explain some of it, but there was certainly an issue going on where their distinctive assets, I don't think, were being utilized well enough. And it's fundamental. It's Byron Sharp fundamental, which, you know, is pretty fundamental. But know what your distinctive assets are and then connect them all the way through that journey, but it absolutely celebrate them in store. And what can be really funny is you see people do fantastic job on their advertising, but not then connect it all the way through to the end of the journey.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, missing a piece then stops the, if you miss a bit of track, stops the train arriving the station, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, and you sure as hell won't find Coca-Cola doing it. So, you know, the competition are the big boys. And if you cannot punch at their weight, you'll be there a couple of years and then the buyer gets bored of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting you mentioned that. I mean, we, a bit like you sort of saying gambling on, not gambling, it doesn't sound like you exchange money, but, you know, you kind of a bit of a handshake on who's on the up and who's on the down in retail. We do the same thing with all the challenger brands that we like to review. Right. Because unfortunately, there is a massive amount of the UK sort of startup sector, which is landfill. And every year there's going to be a churn on that, which is going to end up in landfill. And sometimes there's been, it's the most noisy brands.
They end up at Trevor's Market Shop.
Exactly, yeah. Well, do you know, it's funny you mentioned earlier about the ones that just solve a problem. So two of my favourite brands in the last few years that did not get any of the shout or attention on social that some of the sexy ones got that have now dropped off the planet. But these brands have successfully sold were UFIT, Crunchers by Lacca Foods, and Eat Real, owned by CoFresh. Right. Now, both of those brands executed well. They kept all of their marketing focused on the shopper and meeting a solution, which is all about healthy, convenient snacking. And they just nailed the communication on that front, which is what somebody wants. They got, they Eat Real were getting till space in co-op. It was absolutely mad. And at a premium above other crisps, you know, like Walkers, this tiny little manufacturer in Leicester, how did they do that? It's because their message just got cut through on shelf. We are about new, exciting flavors that are healthy, and it's got more protein in and less fat. And you know, it's an interesting new thing that's not been done before. Hummus shells, I've not seen that before. Everything about that, but they didn't start shout on social. There were no celebrity endorsements. They just nailed the shopper activation. Great brand.
Yeah, and the science of it is, if you focus on one category entry point, and you do it really well, you will win because, and again, that's how Coca-Cola does it. It's just they've got enough money to be able to focus on many different entry points. But if you just focus on one and you do it really well, you'll win. And then once you've got to the point where you've won that, you'll be big enough as a founder to be able to put your feet up and ask someone else to get it right for you so that you can beat Coca-Cola. But, you know, setting out on your ambition to be number one without some foundational blocks in place will only end up with burning money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, look, that's a kind of great point to end on. I'm conscious of your time and the ticking clock on Zoom here. But Alex, it's been an absolute blast. I really enjoyed this. Hopefully everyone listening and watching has. If you've listened or watched the discussion with Alex, please do reach out, follow Alex, follow audience, and make sure to thank Alex for his time. This podcast is all about investing in leaders, investing in leadership. And it's our way of giving back to the industry. And anybody that comes on this show, it's because they want to invest in talent as well. So reach out. Thanks. Do thank Alex for his time. And make sure you follow Alex on LinkedIn. I'm not just blowing smoke up his bum, he's a pal of mine, but he genuinely has some really interesting articles. Go and check it out. Have a look at the comments thread. If you are interested or have got ideas on what you want to see in terms of leadership issues addressed, discussed, explored on the show, let us know and we'll jump on that and find somebody that we rate who can answer those questions. Thank you for listening, everyone. And we will see you soon. Take care.